In 1856, Ulysses S. Grant had hit rock bottom. Forced to resign from the military because of his propensity for drunkenness, he found himself in Missouri, utterly without funds and with no real means of livelihood. As Ron Chernow puts it in his biography, quote, Grant projected a defeated air on the St. Louis streets, a man with the life beaten out of him. His injured pride cast a deep gloom over him. The depression visible in his expressionless face, seamy clothes, and absence of mirth were discernible to those around him. His need to sell firewood on the streets, and Ulysses S. Grant was selling firewood on the street, huddled in a faded blue army coat, broadcast his decline to the world. Great God, Grant, what are you doing? Exclaimed an officer who had last seen him in Mexico. I am solving the problem of poverty, Grant explained. It was in such a state, Chernow further reports, that Grant came upon a good friend of his from West Point, James Pete Longstreet, who had served as best man at Grant's wedding. Longstreet, Chernow writes, was shocked to see how far down the social ladder his old friend had tumbled. Grant, Longstreet recalled, was poorly dressed and really in needy circumstances. The next day, Grant accosted him and pressed a $5 gold piece into Longstreet's palm to repay a debt now 15 years old. Longstreet refused. You must take it, said Grant. I cannot live with anything in my possession that is not mine. Longstreet gave in, giving Grant the small shred of dignity he had left. When they would meet again, it would be at Appomattox Courthouse, when Longstreet, second in command to Robert E. Lee, would surrender to Grant, who was then at the head of one of the largest armies in the history of the Western world. Grant's tale is one of the most extraordinary in American history, in a certain sense more interesting than that of Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, T.R., or F.D.R., precisely because it is a story of terrible lows and astonishing highs, of failings and successes, of falterings ultimately overcome, be they related to his career, his finances, or his personal virtues. Similar lows and highs can be found in Grant's relationship with the American Jewish community. No man in America was more identified by American Jews with the character of Haman from the Book of Esther, seen by them as their implacable enemy, and few presidents ended up being more mourned by the American Jewish community at his death. Drawing on both the scholarship of Chernow and the historian Jonathan Sarna, both of whom I am greatly indebted to, we will tell this story today, and then we will attempt to draw several conclusions of our own. For as we shall see, the story of Grant and the Jews is not merely one interesting episode in the America of the 1860s, 70s, and 80s. Rather, rightly understood, it tells us something profound about the American democratic system, about the American Jewish experience, and the nature of statesmanship itself. We begin with the order that shall live in infamy. In 1862, the career of the once destitute U.S. Grant was on the rise. His February victory at Fort Donelson had earned him the nickname of Unconditional Surrender Grant. In November of that year, he was put in charge of Tennessee Territory, which actually included several states, a great deal of the then Union-occupied parts of the South, Tennessee, Mississippi, and parts of Kentucky. At this time, when the very future of the war very much hung in the balance, one of the Lincoln administration's great fears was that the lure of Southern cotton would draw other nations into supporting the Confederacy. And so, it issued a policy allowing anyone who swore loyalty to the Union to engage in cotton commerce. This drew many merchants to the Union-occupied South to engage in speculation and bidding wars. Some perfectly on the up and up, others more of a shady nature. As Chernow writes, cotton fetched such exorbitant prices in the North that huge fortunes were reaped overnight, and army officers regularly bribed to wink at smuggling. Such practices infuriated Grant, who also fretted that traitors might transmit military intelligence to the enemy. Grant, he writes, felt a special antagonism against war profiteers. At a time of rampant anti-Semitism, Jews ended up as a shorthand for unscrupulous traitors. Of course, as Chernow notes, The great majority of those involved in the illicit trade were Gentiles, but Jews were much easier to scapegoat. It was in this context that Grant issued the infamous General Orders No. 11, which stated that the Jews as a class, violating every regulation of trade established by the Treasury Department, and also department orders, are hereby expelled from the department. Within 24 hours from the receipt of this order by post commanders, they will see that all of this class of people are furnished with passes and required to leave. Chernow notes that this was the most sweeping anti-Semitic action undertaken in American history. And he further adds that the very same day, Grant wrote a letter, quote, expressing a conspiratorial view of these Jewish traitors, endowing them with almost diabolical powers. Grant wrote that, quote, they come in with their carpet sacks, in spite of all that can be done to prevent it. The Jews seem to be a privileged class, wrote Grant, that can travel anywhere. They will land at any woodyard or landing on the river and make their way through the country. If not permitted to buy cotton themselves, they will act as agents for someone else who will be at a military post with a treasury permit to receive cotton and pay for it in treasury notes, which the Jew will buy up at an agreed rate, paying gold, end quote. From this letter of Grant, it would appear that he was a standard run-of-the-mill anti-Semite, charging Jews with using their money to achieve a pernicious power on society. Or, as he might have put it, had there been $100 bills then, it's all about the Benjamins, baby. Yet, Chernow further notes that there was more of a familial link to Grant's extraordinary, egregious, awful overreaction. And this was his own fraught relationship with his father, Jesse Grant. Or, to reverse the famous line from The Godfather, for Grant, his anti-Semitism was personal, not business. There are compelling reasons to think, Chernow writes, that Grant promulgated his infamous order in a fit of Oedipal rage against his father, who materialized in Mississippi with three Jewish merchants from Cincinnati, known as the Mack brothers, who hoped to inveigle cotton trading permits. All year, in an evolving family psychodrama, Grant's anger had risen against Jesse, who sought to exploit his son's position to gain appointments for relatives. As historians recount, the Mack brothers had entered into an arrangement with Grant Sr. on the assumption that he could ensure them entree into a privileged relationship with his son, U.S. Grant. When U.S. Grant refused to play ball, the Macks broke off the agreement. After all, they didn't get what they had been promised. Grant's father then sued the Macks in an Ohio court and lost. This embarrassment for Chernow, the embarrassment emerging for this episode, was very likely the cause of Grant issuing this terrible order in the first place. As shocking and horrifying as Grant's actions were, what happened next is fascinating and inspiring. As the Jewish community mobilized against this edict, and as pleading telegrams from rabbis and laymen were sent to the White House, a man by the name of Caesar Kaskel, a Jewish immigrant from Prussia, who was making a life for himself as a merchant in Paducah, Kentucky, decided to personally fight this edict. Upon receiving word that he was being expelled, he decided to just pick himself up and travel all the way to Washington to see the President of the United States. As Jonathan Sarna writes, Kaskel climbed aboard the steamship called Charlie Bowen, which would carry him and other Jews out of Grant's department, and hastily penned a strongly worded account of their banishment for distribution to the press. And I would add that Kaskel's words to the press are remarkable precisely because Kaskel demands justice not as a Jew, but as an American, arguing that Grant's order should be revoked, not because it was bad for the Jews, but because it was an assault on the American idea. Kaskel's words in his press release are as follows. On my way to Washington, in order to get this most outrageous and inhuman order of Major General Grant countermanded, I ask you, gentlemen, to lend the powerful aid of the press to the suffering cause of outraged humanity, to blot out as quick as possible the stain on our national honor, and to show the world that the American people as a nation brand the author of that infamous order as unworthy of their respect and confidence. Sarna rightly describes Kaskel's journey as a Paul Revere-like ride to Washington, spreading the word of Grant's order wherever he went, determined to do whatever it took to have Grant's order reversed and his faith in America restored. Kaskel arrived in Washington and achieved an audience with the president, who was absolutely uninformed of Grant's actions. However accurate, the account of Caskill's meeting with Lincoln is legendary and is supposed to have taken the following form. Lincoln says to Caskill, "And so the children of Israel were driven from the happy land of Canaan?" And Caskill said, "Yes, and that is why we have come unto Father Abraham's bosom, asking protection." And Lincoln responded, "And this protection they shall have at once." Lincoln immediately ordered his chief of the army, General Halleck, to rescind the order. And though the White House made sure not to be too insulting to Grant, who was really one of the few Union generals who actually seemed good at his job, Halleck did ultimately write the following to Grant. Quote, "It may be proper to give you some explanation of the revocation of your order, expelling all Jews from your department. The president has no objection to your expelling traitors and Jew peddlers, which I suppose was the object of your order. But as it in terms proscribed an entire religious class, some of whom are fighting in our ranks, the president deemed it necessary to revoke it." End quote. When Caskill returned to Paducah, Kentucky, and an army officer asked him under what authority he, as a Jew, had a right to remain in the Tennessee Department, Caskill proudly replied, "By order of the President of the United States." Thus was the infamous Order 11 almost immediately rescinded, and thus did Abraham Lincoln's legacy amongst the Jews of the North grow ever greater. Nevertheless, if, as Isaiah Berlin once famously put it, an anti-Semite is someone who hates the Jews more than is strictly necessary, American Jewry deduced from Grant's egregious actions a hatred of the people of Israel. And untrue rumors began to spread that Grant had expelled the Jews because he had himself planned to unscrupulously take a cut from the cotton sales and did not want Jewish competition. And Jews in the North began to question whether the edict revealed something problematic about the promise of America itself. And here we must contrast Grant's legacy with the Southern general to whom he would be constantly compared by Civil War aficionados. In August 1861, the rabbi of the Ashkenazi shul in Richmond, Virginia, requested a furlough for Jewish Confederate soldiers so that they could come home in September to attend High Holy Day services. Lee denied the request, but he was the one who received it, General Lee, but he did so in an enormously respectful manner. He wrote to the rabbi, "Reverend Sir, it would give me great pleasure to comply with the request, and which I know would be so highly appreciated by that class of our soldiers, but the necessities of war admit of no relaxation of the efforts requisite for its success. I feel assured that neither you or any member of the Jewish congregation would wish to jeopardize a cause you have so much at heart by the withdrawal, even for a season, of a portion of its defenders. Now, I cannot therefore grant the general furlough you desire, but must leave to individuals to make their own applications to their several commanders in the hope that many will be able to enjoy the privilege you seek for them. Should any be deprived of the opportunity of offering up their prayers according to the rites of their church, that their penitence may nevertheless be accepted by the Most High and their petitions answered. That your prayers for the success and welfare of our cause may be granted by the great ruler of the universe is my ardent wish. I have the honor to be with high esteem your obedient servant, R.E. Lee." Now, Lee was being sincere here. We know this because on another occasion, when a Jewish soldier in the Confederacy requested a similar furlough for the holiday, this soldier's captain had written on the application, quote, "Disapproved. If such applications were granted, the whole army would turn Jews or shaking Quakers." Lee, however, overruled this officer and wrote instead on the paper, quote, "Approved, and respectfully returned to Captain so-and-so with the advice that he should always respect the religious views and feelings of others." That was Lee. It is safe to say that in so many issues of moral import at the time, Grant was Lee's superior, but not at this moment in his attitude toward the Jews. Meanwhile, one Jewish officer in the Union Army, whom historians identify as one of the highest-ranking Jewish officers under Grant, an Ohio captain by the name of Philip Traunstein, actually resigned his commission, writing in his resignation letter that Grant's order had exacerbated his own experiences of anti-Semitism in the Union Army. He wrote to his commanding officer that, quote, "I do not wish to argue the question of Order Number 11 being either right or wrong, nor would I, even if I dare to, but I cannot help feeling that as I owe filial affection to my parents, devotion to my religion, and a deep regard for the opinion of my friends, and feeling that I can no longer bear the taunts and malice of those to whom my religious opinions are known, brought on by the effect that that order has instilled into their minds, I herewith respectfully tender you my immediate and unconditional resignation." Captain Traunstein allows us to appreciate what it was to experience Grant's order from American Jewish eyes, but to truly gain a unique perspective on what Grant's actions meant to American Jewry and to Jews around the world, we must look at another piece of writing, this one in Hebrew. And this is the remarkable report of Chaim Gershon Widever, the American correspondent for the Hebrew European Jewish newspaper Hamagid, published in Prussia and read throughout the Jewish world. I'll quote to you just a few phrases, and I want you, those acquainted with biblical Hebrew, to listen carefully, because he's writing in the rabbinic style and goes out of his way to utilize phrases from the Tanakh. And it's important that we know just which biblical book is being referenced. So he writes, Kfar Hoda, I'm going to read in Ashkenazis, because that's how he wrote it. I hope that's not a microaggression against any of your identities. Okay, but if a Sephardic Jew such as myself can embrace the Ashkenazic pronunciation, surely, okay. So he writes, Kvar hodanu lekoreinu anichbadim. I've already told our honored listeners in my previous dispatch. Me'agzeira horo asher gozar hasar Grant, echad misori tzvos balei hatzafon ba'America. I've already told you about what Grant did, one of the great generals in the North in America. Kein gan modanu ki hufra atzas haman horo hazeh. I've also explained how this decree was already revoked by this evil Haman. That's, of course, a phrase from what book? The Megillah, which we just read, Haman Hara Hazeh, Al Yidei HaPresident Lincoln, through President Lincoln. Ochein, however, he writes, Lo no dami kodem mai hoisa chatas, what was the sin of the Jews, he says. Ubameh pashu lahave alemes orazos. What did the Jews do wrong? I didn't report this until now. Well, he says, I'm going to tell you. The reason is, Mipnei kim itu bnei Yisrael hoachodim es harevach. Because the few Jews there lessened the profit, asher haya gam lo mimischar tzemer hagefen, which Grant had from profiteering in cotton. Because he too would take a portion from cotton sales. It's not true, but that's what he had heard, and that's what he's reporting. And then he describes to his readers all over Jewish Europe what happened when Grant issued this decree. Listen carefully. Ubechol ir v'ir, Asher dvar hagzeira magia. Okay, he's quoting literally the description of the reaction of the Jews when Haman's edict is decreed. In every city where this decree was reached, his asvu atoshavim lisya'et kidos mala asos, also a phrase from the Megillah. All the Jews got together to try to figure out what to do, levatel hagzeira ra hahi, to undo this terrible decree. And he describes how they got together some of the most important rabbis in America at the time, Rabbi Lilienthal, Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise, and they had all resolved, Loleches Washingtona, to go to Washington. Gotta love the biblical Washingtona. El ha-president, to the president. Ubevom le-Washington acharei icharu ha-moed. But when they arrived in Washington, I don't think Wise went, but others went, it turned out that they were late. Ki kvar hikdimam, because they had already been preceded by Hey Kaskel. Hey is his Hebrew initial, I think. Hey Kaskel. Vayadaber ma president, who had already spoken to the president. Vayavatel asagzera hara hahi. And he had already undone this decree. And then he writes that originally when Kaskel told Lincoln about this decree, Lincoln couldn't even believe that Grant would do such a terrible thing. But ad asher hotzi Kaskel mecheko, until Kaskel took out of his bosom, es paschegen ksov hados, which is, of course, the biblical reference in the Megillah to Haman's decree, the actual decree upon parchment, and showed it to him. And then vayevatel asagzera. Then Lincoln undid the decree. And then he says, ultimately, he says, omnam od yavo yomo, one day a day will come, he says, even though Grant still holds his commission, concluded Kaskel, the day will come, v'yishalem b'flilim es kol ha-nezek asher esev l'bnei Yisrael ade p'tkudaso hara, that it will be repaid in great measure all the terrible things that he did, all the damage that he did to the Jews with his terrible decree. Ugmulo yashiv b'rosho. And his deeds will be returned on his own head, which is exactly how the Megillah concludes in describing what happens to Haman, that he is hung on the very same gallows that he had set up for Mordechai. Now, I should note, by the way, that when he makes reference to Hey Kaskel, he's writing from America. The editor of the paper Hamagid in Prussia pens a footnote with an asterisk describing who is this Kaskel from Paducah, Kentucky, whom he's describing. Writes the editor, quote, Hey Kaskel, Hazeh, this Kaskel he's talking about, who Yelid Arzenu, he's born in our country, meaning Prussia. Meir Ravitch, from the city of Ravitch. Kasher Higid Lanu Aviv, as his father told us, meaning they're writing in about this Jew in Paducah, Kentucky. The editor in Prussia is writing saying, yeah, we know his father, okay? We've spoken to him. And his father and told us that he's one of the great, who Echad Minichbadeh HaSochrim Beir Paducah. He's one of the honored merchants of the city of Paducah. Now, of course, the people reading this in Europe, they think Paducah is like some tremendous place. And one of the most important businessmen there is Hey Kaskel, one of the honored Jewish merchants of the great metropolis of Paducah. V'achiv HaTzoyer, and Kaskel's younger brother, his father told us, Oved Bavodas Tzva HaTzafon, he actually serves in the army. Ish Amitz Lev, V'gibor Chayal, a very courageous young man and a great warrior. So his father told us, Kichol Hayudim Harabim Ovdim B'Tzva HaTzafon, like all the Jews who serve in the Union Army. So it's amazing. They're reading about this guy in Paducah, Kentucky, and the editors write in and say, oh yeah, we spoke to his father. His father told us that he's one of the most honored merchants in this great city, Paducah, and you think he's great, you should meet his brother. Okay? He's really courageous, like all the Jews in the Union Army. Now this article is actually remarkable in a variety of ways. First, even we can discern in the details of this article how different America truly was for the Jews. While an expulsion of the Jews was a common occurrence in Europe, it's impossible to imagine such a decree in Europe being immediately abrogated because some guy from a shtetl, the European equivalent of Paducah, Kentucky, Kaskel's father's descriptions of it notwithstanding, decided to show up to the palace of a European ruler and demand its revocation. But that's exactly what happened here. The second important note is the biblical references. This language is, as we noted, that of Megillat Esther. And to say that Grant is Haman is to identify him with Amalek, the implacable enemy of Israel. And it means that as Grant would go on to capture Vicksburg on July 4th, 1863, as he went on to be named the head of the Union Army and to accept Lee's surrender at Appomattox, as he would become a legend in his time and a man revered throughout the Union, he would be seen very differently by the Union's Jews. And third noteworthy aspect of this article is the following. One idea at the heart of Purim, the third important note is that the idea of Purim is actually being applied by this article to America. As Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik has noted, if the Purim celebration, one of the most joyous and raucous of the Jewish year, is joined with a preceding fast day, known as the Fast of Esther, it is because built into the Purim story is a premise that is not comforting but terrifying, one which inspires not rejoicing but prayer, and that is the eternal vulnerability of the Jews, the possibility of a Haman arising anywhere, of an Amalek appearing anywhere. And to invoke the Book of Esther in reporting on Grant's edict, to compare him to the villain of the Megillah, is to imply that perhaps, the promise of American equality was a mirage. Perhaps a Haman could rise even in the United States. Isaac Leeser, one-time spiritual leader of Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia, prominent Jewish intellectual and editor of the English Jewish newspaper, The Occident, reflected on Grant's order by writing that it is nowise surprising to us that the present crisis in the affairs of the country has in various ways brought us unpleasantly before the public and has made us feel that notwithstanding the boasted progress of the age, we are still in bondage. Yes, he wrote, that is the correct word. We are still in bondage. Grant's edict, in other words, made the Jews feel that they were vulnerable to Amalek's hatred even in America, and that Grant was the Haman who had revealed just that. Thus, though Grant's order only impacted Jews in a small section of U.S. territory, and though it was immediately revoked by Lincoln, the impact psychologically on American Jewry at the time was profound. We now fast forward to 1868. The greatness of Lincoln was followed by the failures of Andrew Johnson, and Ulysses S. Grant is the obvious candidate for the Republican nomination to follow in the next election. And under the Electoral College, a few thousand votes here and there, as you may be aware, can shift three states and decide an entire election. Democratic papers try to shift these very scales by mobilizing Jewish communities, painting Grant as an anti-Semite, and accusing Grant, as the Hebrew newspaper Hamaggah did, of keeping the money that Jewish merchants had attempted to earn. Here's one poem, an election ditty, that was published in a Democratic newspaper. Quote, "Who drove the Hebrews from his camp into the alligator swamp where everything was dark and damp? Ulysses! Who wrothy at those faithless Jews who kept Pa's shears of cotton dues, all further permits did refuse? Ulysses! Who licensed chaps that would divide with Father Jesse argus-eyed? Who claimed the hair and eke the hide? Ulysses." It's catchy. Okay. Meanwhile, unprecedented political public gatherings by Jews took place against Grant in Memphis, Nashville, Atlanta, St. Louis, and Los Angeles. At one large event in Memphis, it was resolved there that, quote, a man unfit for the high position to which he aspires, that Grant was a man unfit for the high position to which he aspires and incapable of administering the laws to all classes with impartiality and without prejudice. And the resolution added that, quote, Israelites who have respect for our honor and religion, pride for our race, and love for our country should, quote, use every honorable means in our power to defeat the election of U.S. Grant. One speaker at this gathering in Memphis went even so far as to say that, quote, if there was any high place to which the Jews would, perhaps, assist in elevating a man who had so foully abused them, it would be to a place corresponding with that upon which Haman had ended his career, end quote. Meaning, Grant should be hung and thereby elevated, not elevated to the White House. All this was noticed by Republicans, who began to get nervous. Chicago Tribune editor Joseph Medill urged Grant to write a letter to American Jewry that, in his words, quote, would mollify the Jews and give us a good many thousand votes. The Jews of Cincinnati and St. Louis, he continued, are numerous enough to defeat our ticket in both cities, and they are strong enough to hurt us in Chicago also, as they include many of our most active Republicans. They, he continued, are deeply grieved by the general's, that they are deeply grieved by the general's order is undoubted, end quote. The man who would ultimately become Grant's running mate, Schuyler Colfax, the Republican Speaker of the House, had himself earlier fretted at, quote, the danger of losing at one blow the whole Jew vote by his having banished, meaning Grant, the whole of them publicly from his lines at Paducah. What this means is that as distressing as Grant's original edict may have been for American Jewry, it actually produced something positive, which is Jewish political relevance and activism. As Sarna notes, what distinguished the 1868 election was that, quote, more Jews than ever before justified their political loyalties on the basis of their religion. They campaigned as Jews. America had never before witnessed such a public display of power on the part of Jews. To put it slightly differently, many Jews came to the conclusion that they should not feel uncomfortable bringing their Jewishness with them into the ballot box as they considered who the next leader of the United States should be. And this activism produced results. Ulysses S. Grant himself, perhaps concerned about Jewish dislike of him adversely affecting his electoral chances, or perhaps out of true contrition, probably at this point both, decided to reach out. He wrote to former Congressman Isaac Morris of Illinois, who had himself reported to Grant that he, Morris, had been in touch with a prominent American Jew by the name of Adolf Moses. And Moses remained concerned about the meaning of Grant's order. To Morris, former Congressman Morris, Grant penned a mea culpa, and he asked Morris to share it with his Jewish friend, Mr. Adolf Moses. Grant wrote in this letter as follows, "I do not pretend to sustain the order. At the time of its publication, I was incensed by a reprimand received from Washington for permitting acts which Jews within my lines were engaged in. There were many other persons within my lines equally bad with the worst of them. But the difference was that the Jews could pass with impunity from one army to the other, and gold in violation of orders, was being smuggled through the lines, at least so it was reported. The order, he continued, was issued and sent without any reflection and without thinking of the Jews as a sect or race to themselves, but simply as persons who had successfully, and then he adds in parentheses, I say successfully instead of persistently, because there were plenty of others within my lines who envied their success, violated an order which greatly inured to the help of the rebels. Then he added, give Mr. Moses assurance that I have no prejudice against sect or race, but want each individual to be judged by his own merit. Order number 11 does not sustain this statement, I admit, but then I, wrote Grant, I do not sustain that order. It never would have been issued if it had not been telegraphed the moment it were penned and without reflection. That's Grant's letter. Now, Grant did not want this letter made public. In those days, people didn't campaign for president, and they certainly didn't publicly cultivate particular interest groups. But Grant did want the letter's sentiments conveyed to Adolf Moses. And even though Grant may not have wanted the public to know about this, Grant also did not know that the Jewish definition of a secret is something that you tell only one person at a time. And the person Adolf Moses chose to tell was the New York Times. Moses wrote a letter which was published on the Times front page in October before the November election, informing the Times' readers that Grant had made, quote, a reparation, and therefore, quote, the best interests of our country are subserved by the election of General Grant, and I have no diffidence to declare it to the community, end quote. In the end, Grant won by a healthy margin, and so there was no evidence that the controversy ended up adversely affecting his election. But with the election, Grant allowed his mea culpa to Morris and Moses to be released to the public. And he began what Chernow calls a systematic effort to atone for his atrocious decision. And thus began the presidency that did more for the Jews than any other up till that point in American history. More appointments were given American Jewry than by any other previous administration. And Grant himself exerted himself on behalf of Jews, both in America and beyond. Of the examples that we can give, two are particularly fascinating. One involves an assimilated American Jew, and one involves a Jew who was not American and definitely not assimilated. First, we have the case of a young man by the name of Albert Michelson. Early in his first term, Grant received a letter from the senator from Nevada, Thomas Fitch, asking that the president use one of the 10 appointments at his disposal to grant Michelson admission as a student to the Naval Academy in Annapolis. Michelson, the senator wrote, is, quote, a member of the Israelite persuasion who by his example and influence has largely contributed to the success of our cause and induced many of his co-religionists to do the same. These people, he wrote, are a powerful element in our politics. The boy who is uncommonly bright and studious is a pet among them. And I do most steadfastly believe that his appointment at your hands would do more to fasten these people to the Republican cause than anything else that could be done. And he added that if you give him the place, meaning admission, you will never regret it. So young Michelson goes to meet the President of the United States. And the biography written by Michelson's daughter many years later recounts that, quote, President Grant slumped in his chair, received Michelson, and listened with kindness and interest to his story. Drinking, wrote Michelson's daughter, drinking had coarsened Grant's face and rounded his belly so that he no longer looked like the pictures Albert had seen of him as a general charging into battle. But his voice was gentle as he broke the news to Albert that he could not help him, having already filled the 10 appointments at large that were allotted to the president. Michelson then went to Annapolis for an interview. He was told there was no vacancy. And then, quote, embittered and discouraged, his money almost gone, he returned to Washington and boarded a train for San Francisco. Just as the train was about to leave, a messenger from the White House came aboard, calling out his name. Michelson was taken to see the president, who had been persuaded to make an exception in his case. Brushing regulations aside, Grant gave him the nomination for an 11th appointment at large to Annapolis, which he received on June 28th. Michelson, telling the story in later years, chuckled over beginning his naval career by what he thought was, quote, Grant's illegal act, end quote. Thus did the man who had issued the most unconstitutional act pertaining to the Jews in American history, then issue an illegal act to this young American Jew. It reflects both the political power within each state that Jewish voters were thought to wield, as the Nevada senator describes, but it also Grant's lack of prejudice and his predisposition for kindness. Nor was Grant's kindness wasted. This young man, Albert Michelson, took particular interest in the academy, in the sciences, and ultimately became known for his measuring of the speed of light and for what is known as the Michelson-Morley experiment. And in 1907, he became the first American to be awarded the Nobel Prize. Our second example involves a very different sort of Jew, a rabbi from the Holy Land by the name of Chaim Zev Schneerson. And if you recognize the name Schneerson, you're onto something, because he was the grandson of Rabbi Schneer Zalman of Liadi, the founder of Lubavitcher Hasidism. Chaim Zev Schneerson had taken upon himself to travel all over the world speaking about God and his ideas about the ultimate redemption. And obviously, you would find it hard to believe that a Lubavitcher rabbi would be driven to travel to far-flung places around the earth proclaiming the name of God and the imminent messianic age. But if you could summon the imagination to conjure up in your mind such an amazing happenstance, that is exactly what occurred. Schneerson arrived in the United States with a particular political goal, the replacement of the American consul in the Holy Land, whom he had deemed unsympathetic to Jewish needs. And so, like Caesar Kaskel, Chaim Schneerson just showed up at the White House. The Washington newspaper, the National Intelligencer, reported the scene, quote, "Among the callers on the president yesterday was the Rabbi Schneerson from Jerusalem, whose lectures on the Holy Land and whose interview with the Secretary of State have been alluded to in our columns within a week past. Accompanied with two or three private friends, his presence broke in on the informal reception given in his chair by the president to many whom he was favoring with a few words of private conversation." That's a nice way of saying that Rabbi Schneerson crashed the party at the White House. "The president," writes the newspaper, "rose courteously to receive the rabbi, who addressed him in the language which follows. 'Mr. President,' he said, 'permit me to give my thanks to the Almighty, whose mercy brought me here to behold the face of the chosen by the millions of this great nation.'" And then he continued, "Blessed be the Lord, who imparted from his wisdom and from his honor to a mortal." This is, of course, the blessing that one says on the head of state, Asher chalak mikvodo lebasar vadam, who bestows, who shares his glory on a mortal. And it was actually the blessing that I had the opportunity to say over the President of the United States at the White House Hanukkah party several years ago. He then continued, "I do pray, therefore, Your Excellency, to turn your attention to the deplorable condition of my brethren in the Orient, that the principles of the government may be truly embodied in its representative abroad. And I do further pray that Your Excellency may show me that mark of favor which will enable my brethren in the Holy Land, in the hour of need, to seek refuge under the stars and stripes, that this free country and its exalted chief should be blessed." At the close of his address, writes the paper, the president, evidently deeply moved by the rabbi's sincere and feeling words, inquired with interest as to the circumstances affecting the Jews of Jerusalem, which might be guarded by the American consulate, and replied with his wonted quick decision, "I shall look into this matter with care." So a Hasidic rabbi barges into the White House. The president receives him with decency, respect, even reverence. Schneerson himself then journeyed across the American continent and in San Francisco made the acquaintance of a man by the name of Benjamin Franklin Picciotto, a prominent Sephardic Jew, grandson of my predecessor, one of the spiritual leaders of Congregation Share with Israel, FYI, the oldest Jewish community in America. And he urged Picciotto to seek appointment through Grant as American consul to Romania, from where terrible reports had emerged about the persecution of Jews there. Schneerson himself then lobbied the Grant administration for this appointment for Picciotto. And on December 8, 1870, Grant issued this remarkable letter. Quote, "The bearer of this letter, Honorable Benjamin Franklin Picciotto, who has accepted the important though unremunerative position of U.S. Consul General to Romania, saying, not only am I giving this Jew a job, but he's agreed to do it for no pay, okay? Who has accepted the important, though unremunerative, position of U.S. Consul General to Romania, is commended to the good offices of all representatives of this government abroad. Mr. Picciotto has undertaken the duties of his present office more as a missionary work for the benefit of the people who are laboring under severe oppression than for any benefits to accrue to himself, a work which all good citizens will wish him the greatest success in. The United States, knowing no distinction of her own citizens on account of religion or nativity, naturally believe in a civilization the world over which will secure the same universal liberal views. Signed, U.S. Grant. Picciotto went on to a distinguished career in American diplomacy and Jewish activism. And this was the first time, his appointment was the first time in American history, I believe, that a president made the alleviation of the plight of Jews outside the United States a goal of his foreign policy. Then, during Grant's second term, an Orthodox shul, Adas Israel, was built in Washington, D.C., and Grant attended the dedication, the first sitting president to ever come to a synagogue. It bears mentioning that this happened after Grant had already been reelected and when he no longer had any need for Jewish votes. Though now having truly atoned for his anti-Semitism, Grant showed that a Gentile he still remained because he did something no Jew would have done. He showed up on time at shul for the service, and he remained through all the sermons for 3 hours in his seat the entire time. He did, however, show that he had learned something about Judaism by then concluding by making a pledge to the congregation. The tale of Grant and the Jews is fascinating as part of a portrait of a great American figure. But three larger lessons can be drawn. First, even the moment of the most anti-Semitic decree in American history reveals something great and grand about America. Moses Mendelssohn, ladies and gentlemen, was the most famous Jew in Germany, in Prussia, in the Age of Enlightenment. He was also its most ardent advocate for religious liberty. The man who was known for beating Immanuel Kant in a philosophy contest went to see Frederick the Great at his palace and was turned away. Meanwhile, an immigrant Jewish merchant born in that Frederick's land in Prussia with no distinction whatsoever, living in the great city of Paducah, Kentucky, could come to the presence of the United States seeking redemption, and redemption he had at once. Even one of the worst moments for Jews in America reveals how extraordinary the Jewish experience has been in America. Second, we find ourselves today, oddly at a time when many pundits and politicians are criticizing our constitutional system of government, and specifically the Electoral College, as undemocratic. But in part, that is precisely the point. The Electoral College was specifically constructed in order to ensure that the majority in a democracy could not tyrannize a small faction of the country. As Madison famously notes in Federalist 51, it is of great importance in a republic not only to guard the society against the oppression of its rulers, but to guard one part of the society against the injustice of the other part. If a majority be united by a common interest, he continued, the rights of the minority will be insecure. Therefore, in the American system, Madison wrote, whilst all authority in it will be derived from and dependent on the society itself will be broken into so many parts, interests, and classes of citizens that the rights of individuals or of the minority will be in little danger from interested combinations of the majority, end quote. The Electoral College, the Senate, and other not purely majoritarian aspects of the American governmental system were designed in order to protect small groups, to protect, for example, the group of American citizens that Grant's edict had called the Jews as a class. The Jewish story of the election of 1868 shows the actualization and the fulfillment of the Madisonian vision. It is in the Electoral College that the motivation of Grant's mea culpa could be found. And it is that system that allowed the first Jewish political mobilization in American history to be so spectacularly successful. Finally, and most importantly, Grant's overcoming of his imperfections his reparations and repentance for his flaws, is instructive about how we should study statesmen and on what sort of pedestal we should put them. As an American, we live with the immortal legends of two men, Abraham Lincoln and George Washington. It is for this reason that their two birthdays, both in February, once served as ceremonial occasions, only to be horribly combined into the amorphous President's Day. Many grouse with justification that this federal holiday seems to join these two titans of American history with the likes of Millard Fillmore and James Buchanan. At the same time, there are less legendary presidents whose stories are as important to study as that of these two men, if not more so. One cannot learn about Lincoln or Washington without being overcome with awe. Yet there are other members of the presidential pantheon who, in their humanity, are more like us, and the inspiration engendered by learning about their lives might actually be more important for our own moral growth. And Grant is just such a figure. Unlike the president that he served, Lincoln, Grant's remarkable life was littered with moments of embarrassing failure. At the same time, it is his successful struggles to overcome these failings that make his story so remarkable. His military career ruined by drunkenness, the Grant of the 1850s was a man, as you have heard, with no prospects, pitied by his West Point classmates. But the military visionary that emerged in the 1860s also fought a lifelong battle with alcoholism, a battle that he ultimately won. And as a general, Grant, as we now know, committed the most anti-Semitic governmental act in American history, yet later as president, as we also know, he spent 8 years atoning for the stain on his life. After his presidency, Grant foolishly entrusted his family's funds to a young crook and lost everything to a Ponzi scheme. But refusing to leave his wife penniless, a cancer-ridden Grant raced against time to finish his memoirs, and in the process, produced one of the greatest autobiographies in American history, which provided for the sustenance of his family. And so Lincoln's story is legendary. Grant's achievements, a little bit less so. But whose story is more inspiring? The arc of Lincoln's life does not fail to evoke awe. But to be not only awed but inspired by a figure in history, we must feel a sense of kinship. We must believe that he or she is somehow like us, that we can be like them. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein once spoke about two of his teachers, first his father-in-law, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, and Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik's younger brother, my grandfather, Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik. And Rabbi Lichtenstein said that actually, in certain ways, my grandfather, Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, had a greater impact on him, because he said the Rav was such a towering figure, so I had no concept that I could ever be like him. Whereas Rav Aaron, he said, Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, he was for me a pole star, because I could approximate my life to his. Now, when I read this as a child, I was very insulted. I said, what are you saying about my grandfather? It was only later that I understood the wisdom of what he was telling us. Inspiration requires likeness. Growing up in Chicago, I lived in the age of Michael Jordan. I was awed by Michael Jordan. I guarantee you, never once in my life did I think I could be like Michael Jordan. Not once. Even though there was an ad, I want to be like Mike. Not one Jewish child in Chicago actually, truly, ever sincerely believe this. Inspiration requires likeness. And that's why we need heroes that are like us, even if that means they will be flawed. The sensitive reader of the Bible understands this, for it is in Scripture that we are introduced to both Lincoln-esque and Grant-like heroes. We read in Genesis of Joseph, who goes from brilliant boy to vizier in Egypt in a few years, resisting all pagan temptations in the process. Sold into slavery by his brothers, he ultimately forgives them in an astonishing, superhuman act. Yet Joseph's tale also contains another hero, his brother Judah. Judah who conspired to sell Joseph, and then later, in a stunning act of repentance, protects his half-brother Benjamin, and thereby brings about Joseph's own forgiveness. We call ourselves, all of us, not Josephists today, but Jews. We are Yehudim, which means that we model ourselves on Judah, on Yehuda, not because he was perfect, but precisely because he was imperfect, and thereby teaches us that we too can strive, despite our imperfections, for the moral and spiritual life well lived. If America reveres Washington more than any other man, Judaism's most important figure is Moses, declared by Deuteronomy to be the greatest prophet to ever live. Yet nearly as central to the biblical tale is David. David, who, like Grant, was an astonishing military genius. David, who gave in to sin and temptation. But the psalms and the contrition that emerged from his sins endure today as the Jewish paradigm of repentance. The Bible at times showcases lives lived in exquisite near perfection. That's Moses. But it also understands that we need heroes that inspire us in their fallible humanity, people who falter, who fail, who repent, and who overcome. When Grant died in New York City, his funeral was attended by scores of New York's Jews, some of whom had to walk miles on the Jewish Sabbath, all the way up to the upper West Side, honoring the life of the man they had once despised, the man whom they had come to love. After the funeral service, William Tecumseh Sherman, a great general who did not learn to love the Jews, sat and reminisced with Mark Twain, who had published Grant's memoir. Twain, Chernow recounts, reflected that, quote, he had failed to press Grant on one key point that would have completed the human portrait, and now he kicked himself for this critical omission. Grant had not addressed in his memoir his struggle with alcohol. This was a contest, Twain reckoned, a contest as huge as any of the titanic battles that Grant had fought and won. Grant may have been too embarrassed to address this failing, but Twain understood that these imperfections helped make Grant's story all the more inspiring. I wish I had thought of it, Twain exclaimed with frustration. I would have said to General Grant, put the drunkenness in the memoirs and the repentance and reform. Trust the people. Trust the people. Put in the sin and put in the repentance and the reform. Today we rightly honor the legacies of Washington and Lincoln, but we ought to reflect on the lives of our less perfect presidents, some of whom may not deserve at all to be remembered, but some of whom, precisely because of their imperfections, serve as an inspiration to us all. It was the great American historian Groucho Marx who, as Roger reminded me in a conversation we had today, who on the game show You Bet Your Life, out of Rachmanis, would offer a question to even the more pathetic contestants who had not earned any prize. And so the question he would ask them is, who is buried in Grant's tomb? In truth, the answer to this question is not simple. And that is the point. Who is buried in Grant's tomb? What is the moral makeup, the identity of that man? He is a man who faltered and failed and ultimately overcame. And in the case of the Jews of America, had he not failed them, we would not have the extraordinary example of his repentance. Who is buried in Grant's tomb? Not a perfect person by any standard, but it is precisely how he dealt with those imperfections that make him one of the most remarkable and inspiring Americans to ever have lived. Thank you very much.